Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. My guest will be Sarah Porter. She's the Vice President of External Affairs at the Healthy School Campaign, and I'll tell you more about that organization in just a little bit and what Sarah does there when she comes on. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the area, some things in the news, and, of course, my weekly recipe. So I had a wonderful holiday vacation. I hope you all did. Happy New Year. In this new year, we are starting off with a president that is on the brink of taking us to war, which is quite scary. You know, it's not the way that any of us would have wanted to start the new year. But with that being said, you know, I also am very optimistic with this new year. Not only do we have the opportunity to change the administration, but I am just seeing more and more articles and examples of people looking at climate change and the connection that climate change has with their food, and I'm really, really happy to see that. I was watching the Golden Globe last night and found out that they did the whole Golden Globe plant-based, so the meal for 1,000 people was all plant-based meal, and that's just making a great statement as to the necessity of us all cutting back on our animal intake. And I also was really happy to see an article that Melissa Clark wrote in the New York Times food section this past week about mindful meat eating. And she was, you know, acknowledging that she is a meat lover, and yet as a citizen of the world, she knows it's her responsibility to cut down on the amount of meat that she eats, because meat production, the industrial agricultural system, and meat and dairy production are responsible for more greenhouse gas emissions than all of the cars and trucks put together. So it's really a significant amount of emissions that is responsible, that the industrial agricultural system is responsible for, if you take into account the deforestation for grazing of the animals, for growing feed for the animals, the water that the animals drink, the methane that they produce in their belching. You know, it just goes on and on. And so we all need to reduce our meat and dairy intake. And she has some really great suggestions as ways to do that. Mark Bittman years ago, you know, came out with his book VB6, which was Vegan Before Six, which is another way of doing it, you know, doing your breakfast and lunch meals plant-based. And then, you know, when it comes to dinner time, if you want a little bit of animal protein, you know, that's where you can do it. So there's many different ways of addressing the problem and the issue at hand. But just seeing these little sparks of recognition that this is a problem is really heartening for someone who's been, you know, not eating animals for 45 years. So I'm really, really thrilled to see that. You know, and especially all the fast food restaurants, starting with the plant-based burgers. Of course, some of them are very highly processed, so you want to be careful of that. A lot of them contain genetically modified ingredients, and that's not good for you. The Impossible Burger is one that I know is GMO'd versus Beyond Meat, which is not a GMO product. So you really want to just look into all those things before you start eating lots of meat substitutes. But tofu, tempeh, seitan, those are standards that have been around for eons, along with beans and our legume family, which is a wonderful way of eating and getting protein. And one thing that Melissa Clark quoted Marion Nestle, who's a professor emeritus at NYU and an author and just very knowledgeable in food politics. She was just saying, you know, nobody in this country has a protein deficiency. It's just not something people have to worry about. And yet people always worry about it. Like, if I become a vegetarian or vegan, how am I going to get enough protein? And that's really a non-issue. So really don't worry about it. Rudolf Steiner, who was the philosopher behind Waldorf education and biodynamics, he actually talked about, and I've said this many times on my show, he talked about when you eat vegetables, the protein you get from vegetables is a much higher quality, and that also because your organs have to work so much harder to extract the protein from vegetables, it's like exercising your organs. Whereas when you eat meat, your organs can become lazy and not as efficient because the protein is so readily available. So that's another way of thinking about it as well. But either way, however you want to think about it, mindful eating is important, and mindful meat eating is really right up there with that. So give it some thought. Lots of great things going on in and around the area in this new year. My local slow food chapter has two events coming up in January. January 11th, we have a winter wine tasting event at the Village Wine Merchant in Seacliff. That's on Long Island. And we have only a few tickets left. It's almost sold out. And tickets are $30 for members and $40 for non-members. Then we have the Women's March coming up January 18th. The Women's March on Washington is really big. You know, the mission of the Women's March is to harness the political power and diverse women and their communities to create transformative social change. And the Women's March started years ago. It was huge. I went to Washington, D.C. the first year of it, and there was also a great showing in New York. And so there is also a Women's March in New York City. But if you want to go to the Women's March in Washington, D.C., they're asking people to meet at the Freedom Plaza at 10 a.m., and then the march starts at 11:30. Or you can go to the Women's March in New York City, which is starting at 11 a.m. at Foley Square. So either place, if you can make the Women's March, it's such a wonderful, wonderful coming together and bringing women's power into, you know, the headlines. You know, if you watch the Golden Globes last night, or Sunday night, you know, there was a lot of talk about needing to get out there and vote, and women make up such a huge, actually a majority of voters if we all get out there and vote. So we need to make our voices heard and make the world look more like it would look if women ran the world. So let's all do our part and get out there. There's also the NOFA New York Winter Conference coming up, and NOFA is the Northeast Organic Farming Association, and the New York chapter has their winter conference the same weekend as the Women's March. And so while I am on the board, I am not able to go to the Women's March, so I will be at the winter conference up in Syracuse from January 17th through the 19th. If you can join us, the winter conference, that would be the only good excuse for not being at the Women's March, because the winter conference is really a wonderful time to bring farmers and growers and retailers and, you know, anybody who cares about organic food together to learn. And it's really, really an enlightening weekend. So that's where I will be. Also, the Real Truth About Health Conference is starting up again. This is an annual event that has been going on for at least the last 5 years. It is at the Hilton Hotel in Melville, which is on Long Island, and it's an amazing 10-day free conference. And not only is it free, but they offer breakfast, lunch, and dinner, plant-based meals, if you are at the conference. And the lineup is just amazing. So I'm not going to take the time to tell you who's going to be there, but so many people that you want to hear from will be there. So look it up, the Real Truth About Health Conference. And it's on Long Island from January 24th to February 2nd. And Jeffrey Smith, who will be one of the speakers at that conference, after he speaks in the morning, he will be coming to our local slow food chapter and hosting a screening with Slow Food North Shore of his new film called Secret Ingredients. And it's all about, you know, is your food making you sick? And, you know, what is the real story behind GMOs and why do we need to be concerned about it? And our right to know, because so many foods contain genetically modified ingredients and we don't know. So Secret Ingredients, it will be shown at Port Washington from 3 to 5. And it's a free event. So come on down to the Landmark on Main Street, which is where we'll be showing it. February 12th is the continuation of Climate Wednesdays at the Brooklyn Public Library. And this one will be Our Bodies, Our Planet, Public Health and the Climate Crisis at the Brooklyn Public Library. And that's from 7 to 8:30. And that's also a free event. I moderated the last one that was the Green New Meal. And it was a wonderful event. It was sold, you know, not sold out, but the room was packed. I think it could hold 60 people, and we were, you know, people were out the door. So check out Climate Wednesdays at the Brooklyn Public Library starting back up on February 12th, and then it will continue every Wednesday. Not every Wednesday, the Wednesday of the month. And then February 13th, I will be doing a cooking demonstration at the Sustainable Kashi Ashram in Sebastian, Florida. It's a cooking demonstration for pre-Valentine's Day, February 13th, and it's one wok, three meals. And it's an international cooking class. And so if you can make it, if you happen to be in Florida, it is from 6 to 8:30, and you can register online. And those are the events coming up. My recipe this week is super, super simple because it is the vegetable of the month that I am presenting at Glen Cove Public School, where I am the farm-to-school coordinator. And so it's a roasted butternut squash, and I'm really just doing it super, super simple. I'm washing and peeling the butternut squash. I'm cutting the long necks into circles, or you can just cut it into cubes if you'd like. Toss it with a little bit of olive oil, a little bit of kosher salt, and bake it in the oven. You can also put a little garlic on it if you want. You can also put a little cinnamon on if you want that kind of flavor. Maple syrup is really great on it, but I didn't really want to sweeten the butternut squash. I really wanted the kids to taste what butternut squash tastes like by itself, and the kids were loving it. So that is the vegetable I made this week, and I hope you all make it, because it's just such a great winter vegetable. And there's so many things you can do with butternut squash. So you can look at my website at IE Green under recipes and find some other recipes with butternut squash as well, like soup and a mezze that I make that's really great. So check that out. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest, Sarah Porter. As I said before, she's the Vice President of External Affairs for Healthy School Campaign, which is a nonprofit organization out of Chicago, whose mission is to ensure that all children have access to healthy school environments where they can learn and thrive. And in this role, Sarah focuses on building and maintaining relationships with nonprofit organizations, corporate partners, and government agencies, as well as many others. And her past experience in food service, retail management, and event planning served her well when she came to the Healthy School Campaign, because there she got to assist with the second annual Cooking Up Change contest going back 11 years. And Sarah took on both the contest, which includes the rules, the logistics, coordinating teams, etc., and the corporate fundraising program for the event. And with her leadership, Cooking Up Change has grown into a national program. And since 2007, the program has featured more than 2,200 students, and more than 4.7 million Cooking Up Change meals have been served in schools across the country. And she'll tell us more about that when she comes on. And in addition to overseeing Cooking Up Change, Sarah also works on the Healthy School Campaign's Green Clean guide, and they also have a eating guide. And Sarah received her bachelor's degree in political science from DePaul University, and she lives in Wheaton with her husband and three children. So, Sarah, are you with me?
I am. Thank you so much for inviting me to join you.
I'm so glad you were able to make it. I've been watching Healthy School Campaign grow probably longer than you've even been there. When they first started, I think they were just the Green School Campaign, right?
Our green cleaning program was definitely the first component of
right.
the organization. So yes, you've definitely had your eye on us for some time.
Right. And, I've been wanting to get someone from your program on for a while, so I'm really glad you were able to make it. So maybe you could start by just telling us a little bit about the Healthy School Campaign and what inspired you to get involved with them.
Sure. Healthy Schools Campaign, as you mentioned, has been around for a while. I've been here about 11 and a half years, but the organization is going on 20 years now. And we operate on the premise that healthy kids are better learners. It's very simple and straightforward, but we know it to be true. And building on that, we take a look at all of the factors that go into creating a safe and healthy and supportive environment for students and staff as well at school. And I think that we're unique in the sense that there are, we work on school food, we work on green cleaning, we work on the amount of physical education that students get during the day, mental and behavioral, wellness, all kinds of things. But we're one of the few organizations that I think works on so many different aspects. And I think it's exciting because we are really able to kind of take a look at what are all the factors that are impacting students while they're at school, and what are the practices and policies that we can help put in place so that students can best take advantage of the time that they're there and do the learning that is so important. And so at the core, we're an advocacy organization that is really aiming to have an impact on policy change. And sometimes that means with a particular school district, whether it's Chicago Public Schools or another one. Sometimes we're working on state-level legislation, and sometimes it's a federal legislation, depending on the particular opportunity. But all of our work starts on the ground here in Chicago, and we partner with CPS on many of the things that we do to kind of really understand what makes good sense for schools and what doesn't. And then we take those lessons learned and turn them into policy recommendations that we share in other places across the country. That's sort of how we started, and we now have districts that we work with throughout the country and different partners at the state level across the country that we work with on a number of different things. But the idea is always that we're engaging school stakeholders, the parents, the teachers, the principals, the students, the nurses, the administrators, to really understand what the challenges are, understand what the barriers are, come up with creative solutions, and make sure that our policy recommendations are backed up by real proven lessons so that they make sense and can be implemented well and overall support the health and wellness of all students. And so we have a particular focus on low-income communities of color because the health disparities are so dramatic. But we, obviously our policies impact students everywhere. So it's a lot of important work, and a lot of it sort of takes a long time to get the ball rolling. But when we have a win, the impact is big. And so it's been a very exciting and rewarding place to work for the past decade or so.
And you don't work within the school district, do you? You're a separate organization that advises the school district. Is that how it works?
Correct. Yes, correct. So we are a nonprofit organization. We are independent, nonprofit. We're based here in Chicago, though we work in many places. We have a strong partnership with Chicago Public Schools and many other districts, and it makes us well positioned to sometimes do what the districts can't do. We do a lot of stakeholder engagement and bringing community partners together along with the school districts. And other policymakers and key decision makers and influencers to kind of figure out, in a collective process, what are the needs, what are the solutions, who do we need to bring to the table to get something done. So you are correct. We do not work for the district. We're a nonprofit, and we partner with the district and many other companies and organizations.
Mm-hmm. And so do you have representatives that, like, sit in on the different wellness committee meetings that the schools have, or you're completely separate and you just make recommendations? Like, I'm trying to figure out how you get into the schools.
Sure. In lots of different ways. And so, for example, one of the programs we have is called Parents United, and it's a program that engages parents in leadership development and helps train parents in how to train and support parents in how to engage with their schools. So we are not necessarily going to every single school's wellness team meeting, but we have built this network of parents that come together and meets regularly. We provide training and professional development that helps them engage their schools. And so we tend to be more of the folks who are helping different groups of school stakeholders figure out how to go back to their schools and serve as leaders and get involved and help enact change there locally. And so we have similar models with, we did school nurses for a long time, with teachers, for example. We had a whole training program called Fit to Learn that was professional development for teachers. It helped them learn new ways to incorporate physical activity into their curriculum, to have classroom celebrations that aren't only based around unhealthy food, all kinds of things. And so it's more that we provide training and engagement and networking opportunities and support for school stakeholders, and then they become the messengers and the leaders that engage with the schools directly. In general, that's what we do. There are definitely other exceptions as well where we might work more directly with a particular school. For example, we have another program called Space to Grow that is one of the most interesting and creative programs out there, I think. It's designed to help tackle a number of different issues at a specific school. So this one is focused on elementary schools in Chicago Public Schools, and they are elementary schools that are in neighborhoods that have flooding issues. And this program builds new outdoor play spaces for those schools. So maybe they have nothing but a parking lot. Maybe they have some sort of playground that is really old and unsafe for the children. And this program builds a completely new outdoor schoolyard that not only provides unique learning opportunities and play spaces for the students, but has a number of special features that help deal with rainwater, stormwater, and so it reduces the flooding of the neighboring homes because of all the permeable surfaces and the different rainwater features that we have. And so it sort of not only helps the community by reducing the flooding issues, but gives the students at the school a playground and also a whole schoolyard with edible gardens and native gardens, an outdoor classroom space. There's a whole set of curriculum that goes with it to help all of the teachers and the principal make the most out of that space so they can have classes there, all sorts of things. And so in that particular type of program, we select a certain number of schools each year and go and build those play spaces, those space schoolyards for that particular school. So as I mentioned, our work is varied and it covers lots of different things. And I think one of our strengths is that we're able to kind of figure out how to work in different ways with different partners. So it's definitely exciting.
Yeah. And it's challenging because, so, you know, you're right. So many nonprofits really have to focus a little bit more because when you spread out so much or you address so many different areas, sometimes it dilutes it. But it seems like you have you figured out how to do it, which is really great. And now how do you get your funding? Like, I know how expensive doing a whole new green garden schoolyard would be. Where does that finance come from?
Sure. Well, our organization gets funding from a number of sources, from different foundations and grants. We raise corporate sponsorships to support some of our programs, and we have a number of individual donors and that type of thing. So as an organization, we try to make sure that we you know, have a very diverse sources of funding. For the Space to Grow program in particular, it's a partnership where CPS, there are a number of capital partners that CPS and some of the water management agencies contribute to the budget for the schoolyard. We also partner with another local nonprofit called Openlands. And so those partners all, you know, contribute and raise money towards that budget. And so some of it is the direct expenses of building the schoolyard. And then some of it is, for example, we run an entire community engagement process leading up to the design and building of the schoolyard so that the parents and other community members are really engaged. Every school is different. Every neighborhood is unique. And we want to make sure that the schoolyard we're building addresses the particular needs of that particular school and community. And so the process means that the community gets to come and participate and provide input into the features and the needs and how they want to use it so that the designs reflect that specific school. So there's that whole process plus the curriculum that I mentioned. We don't stop engaging with the schools once we build the schoolyard. We don't build it and move on. We continue to provide professional development and programming for all the schools that have schoolyards, you know, on an ongoing basis, and, you know, maintenance of the schoolyards and all things like that. So it's definitely a very unique partnership that brings together a number of partners, and Healthy Schools is one of the key partners, but certainly not the only one.
Mm-hmm. And you said CPS. What does that stand for?
Oh, I'm sorry, Chicago Public Schools.
Ah, okay. Chicago Public Schools, great. Right, but they wouldn't, public schools, they don't have money, right? They don't have money to do the garden themselves, so I would guess you have to really do fundraising and go to your other corporate partners and things like that for the money.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there definitely is a lot of fundraising that goes on for the program, you know, and definitely a lot of, you know, conversations about, you know, what support CPS can give and that type of thing. So it's definitely a combined group effort to bring that all together.
Uh-huh. And so if you're doing something like that where you would actually, in order to engage the parents, you'd actually work through the school, right? You would have the meetings at the school, or do you have an office where you bring the parents to, or do you meet like?
Yes, in this case, we engage directly with the school right. principal, and other staff there. Schools have to go through a pretty rigorous application process to be considered and selected to receive a schoolyard, and definitely having leadership at that school that is excited and engaged and enthused and committed to making the most of it as a key component of that. And so we work directly with the principals and the rest of the staff at the school as we go through that planning process. And they also are the folks in the community that know their community the best. And the great thing about the schoolyards is not only are the students using it during the school day, but it's also open, you know, on the weekends for other community members to use it as well. So it's really designed to be an asset for the entire community.
Mm-hmm. Lovely. Wonderful. Now, you also get involved in curriculum. Is that correct?
To some degree. To some degree, we do. I mentioned our Fit to Learn program, and in that, for example, it was more about training teachers about how they can incorporate physical activity and other healthy habits into the curriculum that they are teaching. So we do a lot of sort of supporting that. We're really trying to make sure that the entire school community is thinking about how to incorporate health and wellness into every aspect of the school experience. It should be kind of threaded throughout and not sort of an afterthought or a side thing that folks are thinking about. And so it's less about, you know, weighing in on whatever, you know, the specific curriculum is, and more about how can you get done what you need to do with your curriculum and do it in a way that is incorporating lessons around health and wellness throughout the entire thing. In a few other places, for example, we have a Cooking Up Change program, the one that you mentioned earlier that I run, which is my favorite thing that we do. It is a healthy cooking contest for high school culinary students, and we challenge them to create a healthy school lunch that can actually be served in their school's cafeteria. But it's something the students are excited about, that they want to eat, their friends want to eat. And we have seen the culinary teachers add and adjust and rearrange their curriculum. They're culinary students, but maybe not necessarily getting a lot on nutrition. And so we have seen a lot of added lessons around nutrition for the culinary programs that are participating in that program, which is an exciting thing as well.
Okay, so I need to back up a little bit. Chicago high school students have a culinary program in the high school?
It's amazing, yes. It's part of the career and technical education program, which is sort of like the old vocational program. Like when I was in school, you had shop or home ec. It's mm-hmm. all revamped and designed to really get students ready to graduate and either go on and study at the college level or be ready to embark on a career and get a job out of school. And so there are many different tracks that you could choose from. There are auto mechanics, cosmetology, there are healthcare tracks, many different things, but culinary arts and hospitality is one of them. And there are about 20 high schools in Chicago Public Schools that offer the culinary arts and hospitality track. And the students that participate get 3 years of culinary training in high school, in addition to all of their other classes. And when they graduate, they have their food sanitation certification and are ready to go out and get a job in a kitchen or continue to study culinary arts at the college level. And so it's a pretty amazing program, and those are the students that are invited to participate in our Cooking Up Change competition.
And how many students participate in the culinary arts program in Chicago Public Schools? How large a school district is it? Like how many students in Chicago?
I think the latest number is about 360,000 students in the district. I don't know the number of students in the culinary program, but there are 20 high schools that offer the program.
Uh-huh. Okay. 20 high schools. That's wonderful, you know, because, you know, let's face it, not everybody is, you know, geared to go on to college. You know, that type of learning is not for everybody. But giving kids a vocation that they can, you know, yeah. that they can love and get a job in right out of school is really amazing. You know, a lot of European countries, that's what they do. You know, not everyone goes to college. You know, many mm-hmm. do internships and, you know, different types of training while in high school so that they can continue on. And, you know, our country, we don't do that so much. So that's
yeah,
really,
we need to do it more. And I think this program, you know, is a good example of that because you're right. Not everybody is going to or wants to go to college, and there are so many other things that we need. And so I think that it really helps prepare students, you know, and they can absolutely go on to study culinary arts at the college level if they want. But if they don't, if they're not interested in that, then they're well prepared to graduate and go out into the workforce. And so the program is, I think, an interesting partnership between the culinary teachers and educators and also the district's food service program, the nutrition support services department that is serving meals to these 360,000 students across the district every day. And because school food service is also an interesting and very viable career path for culinary arts students. And so it's not everybody is going to work in a restaurant. Not everybody is going to, you know, be on, you know, Top Chef. But there are so many different career paths open to folks with culinary training, and school food is just one of many. But I think the program is a good sort of introduction to that as a path for folks that are interested. And it's exciting because the students, you know, I mentioned that we challenge them to create a healthy school lunch that they're excited about, and they're also doing it within all of the sort of realities of school food service. So they've got a very tight budget that they're working with. They're only using ingredients that are available through their cafeteria. They have nutrition requirements that they're meeting, the nutrition requirements of the National School Lunch Program. And so it challenges the students, you know, to kind of flex their culinary skills, but also to really, I mean, there's so much math involved. A lot of, you know, they're writing recipes, a lot of teamwork. They design these meals and they present to a panel of judges. So there's a lot of leadership.
So it's not an individual, they work as teams.
And so it kind of really challenges the students to work on a whole set of different skills that they'll use, you know, kind of well beyond their culinary class in high school. And it also, it's exciting because the team that wins first place will see their meal served across the entire district. And so those students that win have a chance to then, you know that their meal is being served to 360,000 students all across the city. And so it's very exciting. And for the food service department, it gives them access to not only the winning recipe, but a whole set of student-designed recipes, because they're very interested in getting student input so that students will, you know, participate more in school food. They want to make sure that they're serving meals that are appealing to the students. And so it's a great way for them to get very direct student input on what they should be serving. So another kind of very unique and multifaceted program.
Now, when it started, I thought it was just Chicago students, but now I thought it has expanded beyond just Chicago, no?
Correct. So we had the first competition here in Chicago in 2007 and have been doing it every year since, although the one that was scheduled for November of 2019, we postponed till March because of the teacher strike going on. It was sort of happening right around the sort of key final prep time for the competition. So the 2019 contest was rescheduled for early 2020, but we've been doing this every year. And we got a lot of interest from other districts across the country. And so for a number of years, we had a national competition where we were actually hosting cooking up change contests in districts across the country and throughout the school year. And then at the end of the school year, we would bring the first place team from each location to Washington, D.C. to compete against one another in the national finals. So we had as many as 10 different districts in one school year, but I think over the years, a total of 22 or 23 different participating cities across the country. And it was a really exciting way for us to engage more students, to engage more food service directors, and also, you know, going back to what I mentioned about the core of Healthy Schools campaign is our advocacy work. It was the perfect vehicle to have students really be the messengers. When we would go to D.C. for the national finals, they would compete, but they would also spend a day on Capitol Hill meeting with their legislators and talking about why healthy school food is so important. And so it was a really exciting opportunity for the students who've done all of this work, and they've learned so much about healthy eating and healthy cooking and what they're putting in their bodies and how that makes them feel. They became the excellent messengers for advocacy messages around school food once we were in Washington, D.C.
Sure. Sarah, let's take a couple-minute break. When we come back, I actually want to talk about the school food, because it's sounding like you know, your students are cooking with raw ingredients, and I don't know if you caught wind that I am actually the farm-to-school coordinator at a local public school here. And the school food is just horrendous. I mean, I'm trying to make it better, but it all comes in frozen, and it's very little raw ingredients are they working with. So my guest is Sarah Porter from Healthy School Campaign out of Chicago, and we're talking about school food. So, Sarah, right before the break, I was asking you what kind of food Chicago District serves now. Do you do scratch cooking in your schools, or are your schools similar to my schools here in Long Island, where the majority of the food is coming in frozen and is just being heated up on sheet pans in the oven?
Yes, well, and the answer answer is complex, and the answer is both to some degree. There's a lot of Chicago Public Schools is doing a lot of really exciting and sort of groundbreaking things in the world of school food. For example, we were part of our work with Chicago Public Schools around their food program resulted in the first scratch cooking that happened in the district in decades. I mean, no one could remember when was the last time any raw protein was prepared in any of the school cafeterias. And we helped work out a partnership. It turned out that there were a number of Amish farmers in Indiana, not far from us, who were selling their chicken breasts to Whole Foods, their chicken thighs to Chipotle, and did not have a buyer for the chicken drumsticks. And now Chicago Public Schools purchases those chicken drumsticks and serves them in their cafeterias. And in order to do that, the logistics of making sure their kitchen facilities were ready, making sure their staff was ready and trained, because they had not been scratch cooking in so long. And it happened pretty fast over a summer, and now it's one of the most popular items on the school menu. And our Cooking Up Change program has featured a number of different winners where that is the main ingredient. And so I think that's an exciting example of how the district thinks creatively and takes advantage of opportunities where they come to put a less processed, healthier item on the menu. In addition, the reality still is that, the challenges of providing meals on that scale to so many students and working within the parameters of the National School Lunch Program, it is always a challenge when the reimbursement rate from the federal government, only gives the schools so much money to provide these meals. And so you tend to see more processed frozen items. One thing that has been exciting, though, is that the shift that we've been seeing, in particular since the last reauthorization of the Child Nutrition Act in 2010 under the Obama administration, is the move more towards whole food, less processed, fresher, healthier meals. And it's a slow needle, for sure. It takes a while. But we worked a lot on that piece of legislation, and we were excited because previously the nutrition requirements read like a long list of nutrients. You needed so much vitamin A and vitamin C and riboflavin, for example, which all made sense, except for the way it played out was that you could take a donut and fortify it and it would meet your nutrition requirements, which certainly is not the definition of healthy eating. Mm-hmm. And so the last update, really the nutrition requirements were revised to be more around whole food planning. Now you see you need a cup of green vegetables, a half a cup of fruit, that type of thing. And in particular, there was the addition of the limits on sodium, and it's definitely been a shift since the Trump administration has rolled back a number of those requirements. And so, school districts and food providers were sort of on this path of coming up with less processed items that were lower in sodium, especially, and the Child Nutrition Act was really kind of pushing that, and now has sort of not only been halted but rolled back a bit. And so that has definitely been a frustrating time. I will say it is exciting to see that Chicago Public Schools and a number of other districts have chosen not to roll back their nutrition standards, even though they legally are able to. They have chosen to continue to serve to the higher nutrition standard, but not every district is doing that. So it is an unfortunate state of events, I would say, around school food currently.
Add it to the list, right?
Add it to the list. The one other thing I would mention, there's so many things, but one thing I would mention that Chicago Public Schools is doing that's very exciting. It's been a few years now since the establishment of the Urban School Food Alliance. Chicago Public Schools is one of the original members. and I think originally it was the five largest districts across the country, and it has grown now to 9 or 10 different districts. But New York and LA and Houston and Miami and others have joined forces to combine what was their individual and significant purchasing power is now combined. This alliance really kind of means that when they decide that they want to see something in the marketplace, they can go out and talk to food vendors and say, okay, we need a different chicken product that is less processed, has less sodium, or whatever the case might be. And they've got more power and elbow room to do that because they're all on the same page and using their combined efforts to kind of sway that market. And so, you know, that is definitely happening, and I think it's interesting and unique and powerful and something that CPS has been participating in. So I think there's more to come from them, and you know, regardless of what the law says, just as you said, people want better food, less processed food for their children, and so there's certainly more work to be done on the school food front.
Yeah, I mean, the Urban School Food Alliance, with that purchasing power, they were able to get biodegradable paper goods, mm-hmm. you know, the biodegradable trays instead of the styrofoam trays. Mm-hmm. They made a lot of good change.
Yes, and they're not done. So, and they're, you know, they're growing, and so that's a really great thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to see what more comes. You know, sort of what their next objectives and priorities are. But I think it's definitely an exciting way to approach things. They've got a lot of impact. They represent a lot of students.
Yeah, I know. I've been, you know, finding working in the schools quite frustrating because, you know, I'll look at ingredients like, you know, they do brunch for lunch, right? So they're doing frozen French toast sticks, right, for lunch. Mm-hmm. And I was like, sure, the ingredients are going to be horrible because they looked like bright yellow. And I looked at them, and they were, you know, the ingredients were not that bad. You know, there was turmeric coloring for helping make it yellow, and you know, but they were, you know, of course, who knows about GMO and whatever. But there wasn't artificial preservatives and artificial colors and all that kind of stuff in it. But then they serve with it the pancake syrup that is horrendous. It's just, you know, corn syrup and glucose syrup and caramel coloring and artificial flavoring, and I'm like, I don't get it, you know. And I was making apple cobbler, and I asked them to order some honey so I could make the apple cobbler. And the only honey even available, I mean, she thought she ordered me honey. And then when I got there and I started to get ready to make my apple cobbler, I looked at the honey, and it was not honey. It was honey blend. And that was the only thing even available on their bid sheet. You could not order real honey. This honey blend, the first ingredient was corn syrup. The second ingredient was glucose syrup. You know, honey was way down at the bottom, including, you know, artificial flavoring. And it was, you know, so frustrating. I said, return it. And I ran out to Costco and got some real honey. You know?
Yeah. And that's definitely the challenge because schools, you know, you see a lot of those types of ingredients when, you know, schools, you know, they're always balancing what they can afford.
No, but I'm telling you, the honey is more expensive than the real honey at Costco. That honey blend was more expensive.
It's amazing how sometimes, like, the logistical machine struggles to kind of incorporate small things like that. Like it seems like it would be simple to run out to Costco and buy honey. And sometimes in smaller cases, you know, with individual, you know, with smaller districts, it might be simpler. With a district the size of Chicago Public Schools, you know, where all the schools are in part of the same program and being, you know, their meals are being provided by the same program. It's amazing, you know, what it takes to add things to the ingredient list, to remove things, to change things. You know, it's definitely challenging, and there's a lot to do. And one thing that we worked on, that's an example of our work here in Chicago, we partnered with Chicago Public Schools to convene a school food advisory group. And the district really wanted some community input and guidance and feedback on their food program. And so we co-convened this group that has done a number of things, but most recently, two big key projects. One is that the district had adopted a list of ingredients of concern, which the Urban School Food Alliance and others have done as well. And so the whole list of ingredients that were different kinds of artificial flavorings, colorings, a whole set of them. And this group helped the district prioritize, okay, we want to get rid of all of them. We're committed to getting rid of all of them, but how should we prioritize where to start? Because they won't all disappear overnight. And so this is a group that helped the district kind of break down, okay, you know, these are of this list, these are the worst, and we should work on these first. Or, you know, these items that you have on your menu maybe have one ingredient of concern, but they're served every single day. Bread items, for example, on the menu every single day, and they have one ingredient of concern versus a meatball that maybe has four of these ingredients of concern but only shows up once a month. Right. And when we get down to, like, literally making on-the-ground change, this was one way that we brought together the school food advisory group, and they helped the district kind of take a look at, here are the ingredients, here are all the menu items currently being served, and which of these ingredients they include, and how should we go about prioritizing tackling them. And so the district is in the process. They've already eliminated some, and they're in the process of eliminating others and going out to their vendors and saying, okay, we're getting rid of all of this stuff. What else do you have for us? And so it's a, you know, it's sort of an interesting way that Healthy Schools Campaign is able to support the district and help sort of give them direction and also community buy-in. The other thing that came out of it was that through this process, we realized that the district did not have one central place where all of their food policies, practices, commitments were codified and made available. And so we worked with the district to put together a report that is now a public-facing document that has the Nutrition Services Department's mission, their vision, their values, what they're currently doing, what they're doing next, how they're going to get there. It's all in one place. It is a document that, you know, informs their bid process, is available to anybody, all parents and anyone else that wants to take a look at it. And so sometimes districts are doing a really some really good things and not telling anyone about it. And that was definitely some of what we found with Chicago Public Schools. There's always more work to do, but there were also a number of really interesting and exciting things happening that nobody really knew about or very few people knew about. And so figuring out how to make sure to package that information as well has been another thing that we've been working on. So it's a very big and complex issue, and certainly the rollbacks on the National School Lunch Program, you know, make it even trickier and something that we're continuing to work on. But it's not a simple thing at all by any means. Mm-hmm. It's quite challenging.
And how many schools are there in the school district? I know you have 360,000 students. How many schools is that?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know that number off the top of my head. It's all changing.
And do all the schools do their own cooking, or do some of the schools cook for other schools? Like in our district's small. There's only six schools in the district, four elementary, one middle, and one high school. But the high school does cook, you know, two of the elementary schools don't even have kitchens. So the high school does cooking for one of the elementary schools, and the middle school does cooking for the other elementary school.
Yeah, they have sort of like a central hub or school that's providing for another. I believe that the number is something like 600 different schools in the district. It's a lot of schools. One of the other commitments that CPS had made a number of years ago that's included in this document that we helped them produce is that they wanted to move away from serving frozen meals in any of the schools. And so with a district that size, the schools, you know, there's a lot of varying, a lot of degree of variance in terms of the kitchen facilities. And so the district went through and upgraded a good number of them a couple of years ago, so that where there were schools that, you know, needed more, and some of this was related to the scratch cooking of the chicken as well, but they wanted to move, they had a commitment to eliminate the frozen food program that they had, which didn't serve all schools, but some of them. And so in order to do that, they upgraded the kitchen facilities in every school where it was feasible given the space. And then for the ones that simply couldn't be, they switched to a different vendor that brings in meals that are pre-made and pre-plated, but are fresh and never frozen. So that was a definite step forward. And in most of the other schools have a cafeteria where their food is being prepared on site. I don't want to say all of them. The district is so big. There are always a few that are anomalies, but for the most part, the schools are preparing their food there at their school and serving it. And the current contractor that has the contract at Chicago Public Schools is Aramark, and so they're the food service provider that is doing all of that.
Right, and Aramark, you know, we had that in my children's public school too. And, you know, where Aramark, I've worked with them in colleges, they can do an incredible job and they can be aware of local and, you know, regional food, this and that. In the elementary and high schools, because the money is so different, it's not that, you know. They really, you know, we had put it out to bid looking just for, you know, a food service that would do all soups made from scratch. And they said they were doing that, and then you look, and you know, but they're using a chicken base for the, you know, for the soup. So it's not really being made from scratch. It's, you know, starting with bouillon, basically.
Right. Yeah. And of course, there's, you know, no doubt that we wish that every student could go to a school where they're, you know, they're able to eat a meal that is all organic and fresh and delicious and amazing. We want that for everyone. But the reality is that especially, you know, in schools that are in low-income communities where the students are getting their school lunch for free or reduced price, it is very challenging for schools to work within the budget that they get as part of the federal school lunch program. And so increasing that reimbursement rate, you know, is one way to be able to get schools to have a little bit more money to work with to buy better ingredients. And that's part of what we see even in our Cooking Up Change program, when the students are looking at this list of ingredients from their cafeteria and they're looking at the budget and the nutrition requirements. They're having to make choices on their strategy. Maybe they want to, you know, they're also limited in preparation steps because you can't do something that will take forever. It has to be pretty straightforward. And so you'll see students that maybe choose to use a bottled salad dressing because they want to use more of their money on and their preparation steps on the fresh ingredients for the salad or their fruit side dish or what have you. Or you might see some, you know, a student who is choosing to use, you know, a frozen, you know, protein item in their main dish instead of the raw chicken drumsticks because they want to make sure that they've got more fresh fruits and vegetables instead of frozen or canned. And so within that one meal and that budget for that one meal, you know, you always kind of have to find a balance of how you want to spend your money and your time and on what kind of ingredients to produce the best meal. And so it's definitely not an easy thing to do. And it's, you know, even now, especially with the Trump administration's proposal on the changes to the SNAP program will affect the school lunch program even more.
I was going to ask you about that. Yep. Same with ours. We're just about out of time, but I wanted to ask you, if people are listening and they want students in their schools, their high schools, to be able to participate in the Cooking Up Change, is that something that schools can reach out and participate in? And how would they go about doing that?
Absolutely. They can contact me. They can go to our website and find my information at healthyschoolscampaign.org. We have a whole set of Cooking Up Change contests. Documents. It's a kit that we can give that we're happy to share with folks who want to have a Cooking Up Change program in their or a competition in their own school. It's a, as I mentioned, it's a really interesting and unique program that challenges the math, the reading, the writing, the teamwork, leadership skills of the students, and so the culinary teachers love it.
Do they have to have a culinary program?
Happy to share those resources.
I'm sorry. Do they have to have a culinary program in their school in order to do it, or can it just be, you know, like a home ec class?
Yeah, no, absolutely they can. Our program, when we hosted here in Chicago, was always culinary students, but anyone is welcome to use the materials.
Wonderful.
To have their own competition.
Well, I will share your information on my website, too, and share it out there so that people can find you. Sarah, I want to thank you so much for the work you're doing and for joining us today. It's been really great.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Sure. And everyone out there listening, thank you so much for joining us. Have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you again next week. Bye for now.